As I recounted these things, Jim Colvin's mouth dropped wider and wider, and he said, "Well, how do you know all this?" I said, "Well, you forget that Wally Duell was a cub reporter under me when I was news editor of the Illini back in 1922. In those days, I remember Wally used to work nights with me over here on Green Street, and when we put the paper to bed, we'd go in Greasy Spoon number 2 and have French toast, and then go home and get 2 hours of sleep and get up and study at 6 o'clock. But Wally was always that way. I can remember him with that little green toque on in the wintertime. And he was out to be a newspaper man. And we glory in his success because he has had great success. And it's a privilege to introduce Wally to you today, because here is an Illini product who has done a great job, and the university can take pride in this type of product. Wally Duell.
Mr. Chairman, Fred, President Stoddard, President Willard, just before I started out on this errand, I told the Secretary of State that I was coming out to speak at Founders Day on certain aspects of our foreign policy, and I asked him to give me his blessing. I said I thought that the occasion called for it. He blessed me. I couldn't see both his hands, and I don't know whether he had his fingers crossed or not. But after I had obtained his blessing, I said, "Mr. Secretary, for a small charge, I would be willing either to omit or to include anything that you would particularly like to have omitted or included." And he said, "I'll have to study your scale of fees before I can give you an answer to that offer." And I never had the answer. And I relate this so that you may understand that I am not committed or bound in any way. Since he did not offer to pay a fee, I can say just what I please. I'm going to read this. It's a habit one acquires, I suppose, after 25 years of association with diplomatists, as our British cousins call them, or diplomats, as we do. And besides, you know, as the lady said, how do I know what I think until I hear what I say? The Secretary of State began an address on another university campus a few years ago with an observation which seems to me to be relevant to our proceedings here this evening, and I should like, accordingly, with your permission, to quote it. One of the splinters of inquiry, which might be worth a footnote in a PhD thesis, is why people almost everywhere in the world like to take pot shots at the members of their foreign offices, the Secretary said. Some of the reasons are pretty obvious and perhaps too embarrassing to delay me here. But in part, they have to do with the vital stake which everyone has in the foreign relations of his country, and in part with the belief that these problems are easier than they are. At any rate, one who has been on the receiving end of this dispute for some years comes back to an observation of Senator Barkley on the floor of the Senate a year or two ago. The senator, then the majority leader, was confronted with criticism because he could not satisfy at once all the demands which several of his colleagues were making. He said that his attitude toward criticism was like that of the farmer's dog who used to go to town with his master. While the farmer was busy, small boys would catch the dog and tie tin cans to its tail. The dog got so used to this that whenever he saw a tin can, he backed right up to it. I imagine all of us who are concerned with foreign affairs, whether our concern is with teaching or reporting or with the practice of diplomacy, have often felt like that dog. I certainly have done so on a good many occasions in the performance of all three of these functions. The Secretary suggested in the remarks I have quoted two of the reasons which may help explain why it is that those concerned with foreign affairs are so often the objects of mayhem. I should like to suggest that another factor is a much more important cause. I should like to suggest that the principal cause is that there is a profound and widespread misunderstanding of the whole nature of world politics, and that this basic misunderstanding is the origin of many, if not most, of the assaults upon even the best of our diplomatists, our teachers, and our writers on foreign affairs in the periodical press, and of the vehemence and vituperation which characterize these assaults. The best of the professionals who deal in one capacity or another with foreign affairs know, of course, what the true nature of world politics is. Indeed, they take it for granted. It is an assumption on which they act, a point of departure from which they proceed. They seldom discuss it. They think it is too obvious to discuss. The professionals, the experts in any field, tend to take the same attitude. They all tend to take the first principles of their disciplines, their specialties, for granted. It may be that in other fields it is safe and even desirable for the professionals to do this. Perhaps in other fields the layman knows what the assumptions are on which the professionals proceed, or perhaps it doesn't matter particularly whether or not the layman knows them. I put it to you, however, that neither of these happy conditions obtains in the field of foreign affairs. The layman does not know what the basic assumptions are, and the fact that he does not know matters a very great deal. Perhaps it is of no great consequence, except to the professionals themselves, that they are so often set upon and beaten about the head and body with the blunt instruments of abuse. Perhaps it is of no great consequence, except to the dog, that he has so many cans tied to his tail. It is a matter of very great consequence indeed, however, if the layman behaves as he does for the reason that he does not understand what the professional is trying to do and why. And this, I suggest, is all too often the case. It matters in this event because the layman is the taxpayer, the voter, the legislator, the reader, sometimes the editor and publisher, yes, and the student and the soldier, who in the last analysis determine what the foreign policy of the Republic may and may not and shall not be. And if the layman does not know what a foreign policy is, or what it is designed to accomplish, or what it is capable and incapable of accomplishing, or what the nature of the milieu is in which it must operate, then the future of the Republic is dark indeed. I should like to suggest that this is, in fact, the case. I believe it to be true that there are misunderstandings on these points so general as to constitute one of the principal weaknesses in America's world position today. I put it to you, therefore, that all of us who deal professionally with foreign affairs have a duty to perform which most of us commonly neglect, the duty of making a much greater effort than most of us now make to explain the essential nature of world politics and to show how day-by-day developments in the field of foreign affairs must be considered with reference always to that essential nature. I should like to attempt to employ that approach this evening. I should like to begin by considering what the essential nature of world politics is. I should like then to suggest that certain conclusions can and indeed must be drawn from this essential nature of world politics as to the manner in which this or any other nation must conduct its foreign relations if it is to survive and prosper. Finally, I should like to show the influence of these basic considerations on certain facets of American foreign policy today. This may seem like a good deal to try to accomplish in a limited amount of time, and I remember a remark which Mr. Winston Churchill made on the occasion of a visit to this country, which indicated a similar condition of spirit. A friend of mine was one of those who received the prime minister, this was during the war, and escorted him to Washington on a special car of a train from New York. And as the train came up out of the tunnel and started across the Jersey Flats, somebody produced a bottle of very fine cognac, and glasses were procured, and everyone relaxed with a glass of the cognac. And the prime minister had a few snickers, and he became jovial and relaxed, and he looked about him in this parlor car, and he said, "I dare say that in my time, I have drunk enough of this splendid stuff to fill such a car." Well, one of the members of his party was Professor Lindemann, now Lord Chirwell, the principal scientific advisor to the prime minister, and this was a challenge to Professor Lindemann. He went off in a corner with his slide rule, and he he estimated the cubic content of the car, and he estimated the cubic content of Mr. Churchill, and he estimated how many years the prime minister had been drinking cognac, and he came back and said, "Mr. Prime Minister, I'm sorry, but you have overestimated your consumption. You've only drunk enough cognac in your life to fill this car up to the lower window ledge." The old gentleman was much taken aback by this. He didn't like it a bit. And he said, "Lindemann, can this be true?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I'm sure it's true. And the old gentleman looked around and he said, "So much to accomplish and so little time." I propose to do this. What I'm going to do, not what Mr. Churchill did. I propose to do this not because I suppose for a moment that this audience is unaware of what the essential nature of world politics is. I assume, on the contrary, that this audience, more than most others that could be assembled, knows perfectly well what the essential nature of world politics is. It is precisely because of this that I make bold to adopt the approach I do. It is in the hope that you who can will perfect a technique of which my remarks can constitute only the most tentative and inadequate beginning. A technique for discussing and explaining day by day developments in world affairs in terms of the basic and essential realities, and thus make it possible for others and ourselves to employ it to some useful effect when it has been better fashioned. I undertake this, believe me, with appropriate humility. I do not think I know all the answers. Sometimes I am not at all sure I know any of them. I find, as William Allen White did, that the older I get, the oftener I say perhaps. Indeed, I take much to heart the adjuration which Cromwell addressed to the Parliament. "My brethren, by the bowels of Christ, I beseech you," said Cromwell, "bethink ye that ye may be mistaken." I may be mistaken, but let us at least make the attempt to do something which I devoutly believe it is important to do. What is the essential nature of world politics? What is their essential quality? It is, of course, lawlessness. Lawlessness. The nations or the states of the world live in a condition which G. Lowes Dickinson and others have called international anarchy. There is no law in the ordinary sense of the term among these states. No law, no police, no courts, no jails, no electric chair. There is only the law of the jungle, eat or be eaten. In the last analysis, it is all a question, as Lenin, or perhaps it was Stalin, said, of who whom, that is, of who eats whom. And as Wemy de Gourmont observed in an only slightly different connection, when it is a matter of not being eaten, all means are the right ones. There is an unrelenting struggle among the nations or states which are the denizens of the jungle of world society. It is inevitable that this should be so. For in the first place, in the absence of enforceable supranational law, every nation's independence, sovereignty, and indeed survival depend on its being strong enough relative to other states to prevent the others from imposing their will on it. The only way to be sure of not being eaten is to be too strong to be beaten. There is, under these circumstances, no such thing as complete or final safety, and there can therefore be no end to the struggle to keep free and live. For relative strengths are constantly changing. They change with every change in the myriad elements which constitute strength and weakness, with birth rates and death rates and disease rates and literacy rates, with industrial peace and industrial strife and industrial production, with genius and scientific invention and diligence and technological application, with psychological states and moods, determination, resignation, guilt, despair, and with literally countless other variables, yes, including moral soundness and confidence of conscience. There is probably nothing in the life of the most obscure child in the most remote corner of the world that could not, under the right circumstances, become a political factor, as Edgar Ansel Maurer has said, because there is almost nothing that cannot be an element of national strength or weakness. Even if it were not a law of nature that changes of relative strength must constantly occur, it seems to be a law of man that he must make them occur. For those who wish to obtain or retain things which can be secured only by changes in the distribution of power, try constantly to alter it. And those who wish to obtain or retain things which can be secured only by maintenance of the distribution of power, try constantly to preserve it.